Good morning. This is Kim Bader,
And Scott Oschak.
and we're reporting for Kootenai Co-op Radio today, and we have three special guests. Jenny Barron, who is the chair at the Muir Center for Peace and an instructor with the Peace and Justice Studies program, and Raja Khoury, who is the CEO of Khoury Conversations, a human rights and inclusion consultant, the founding president of the Canadian Arab Institute, board member at Project Rosanna, which is in Canada, and a former 10-year commissioner with the Ontario Human Rights Commission. He is Canada committee member of Human Rights Watch and co-founder of the Canadian Arab Jewish Leadership Dialogue Group.
Hello, Ken. Good to be here.
Yes, thanks for joining us. And I'm going to ask Scott to introduce Jeffrey.
Our third guest is Jeffrey Wilkinson. He's an American Jew who lives in Canada. He holds a doctorate in education from the University of Toronto and works actively in the Jewish community and beyond on issues relating to trauma and the Israel-Palestine struggle. Jeff's partnership with Raja is born out of deep listening and learning together and has become central to his work.
On Tuesday, December 5th, from 7 to 9 p.m., these two guests will speak about the concept of the wall between, which is also the title of their new book. The wall between is a concept that people can relate to easily, as the idea of a wall has been prominent in the history of conflict for a very long time. Let's start by setting the context for the idea of the wall between with Jews and Palestinians. In your book, you've identified that there are meta-narratives that have developed and are now deeply embedded for everyone. What are these deeply embedded meta-narratives?
Sure, I'll start. A meta-narrative is an overarching story that leaks its way throughout a group's identity, way of expression. So for Jews, it is primarily the Holocaust, is the overarching trauma that leaks through our being and through our thoughts, and often is the stimulus for reactions to current events. For Palestinians, it is the Nakba, which is the reference point of 1948 when Israel was established as a country. There was a war, and as a result of this war, about 750,000 Palestinians had to flee their homes. About 400 Arab villages were destroyed. The Arabic word for this is Nakba, which means catastrophe in Arabic. And these two overarching traumas are really responsible for a lot of the difficulty in us hearing each other.
That's a compelling description. You know, you're describing trauma and disaster. How does that play out now as we see Palestinians and Jews in Israel still struggling? What's actually happening inside of people?
I can give you a couple of examples. As to how these meta-narratives have sort of manifested themselves recently. You know, the large number of Israelis that were killed on October 7, which has been described as the largest number of Jews killed in a single day since the Holocaust, evokes memories of the Holocaust itself, of the pogroms that happened in Europe in the late 19th and early 20th century. And to people with that memory, which was passed on through generations, and that trauma, the reaction was bigger than what it would have been had this been an isolated incident without a historic reference. For the Palestinians, similarly, seeing long lines of civilians walking down the road from northern Gaza to the south, it looked very much like the pictures we've seen of Palestinians walking out of Palestine back in 1948 and, you know, being driven into the neighboring countries and becoming refugees and after losing their homes and their society, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, so you're describing the situation as people in a way being triggered into past trauma that today's conflict brings up, and it feels and looks similar or the same.
What I would add to Kim is that trauma is never past. It is the recurrence of the past in the present. What we've actually been experiencing in a heightened sense recently is the feeling that trauma is not actually being in danger or being threatened, but feeling that you were in danger or being threatened. And we have seen, as we talk about things like protests and the reactions to protests here in Canada, we see people feeling threatened and that heightening their alert system when they may actually not be being threatened. But our brain really can't sort out the difference between feeling threatened and being threatened.
Now, you two have developed a long and fruitful relationship of working together. How did you two overcome the wall that could have and did exist between the two of you?
Well, you know what? It's not too hard to shatter that wall when you have basic agreements on values. Both Jeff and I are people who are deeply committed to human rights, freedom, equality, social justice. And some people are able to be driven by these values and separate them from, you know, their traumas. In fact, theoretically, I believe everyone can do that. And in fact, this is what we called for in our book, is to help people to move off from being driven by trauma and by propaganda and tribalism, to become driven by values. The values that we all profess to have, you know, as people who live in a democracy and believe in human rights and all that. These values, along with honesty and integrity on both sides, can really beat any wall.
Beautifully said, Raja. And I would just add that there is a deep wall that exists if Raja and I stayed siloed only in our communities. So if I spoke to Raja only as a Jew and he spoke to me solely as a Palestinian, we might have some very thick concrete walls. But we speak to each other from a wider circle. We speak and listen to each other as two humans that are seeking to understand. We don't listen to each other to respond to each other. We listen to each other to understand each other. So we have a basic dynamic that the wall is shattered because there really isn't one, because the circle that we've created is a circle of human belonging and trust and values, not a circle centered in two facets of our identity, because our identity is much, much broader. I think the key to our work is that our tribes have really been pulled deeply into a vortex of your identity as a Jew or a Palestinian is all of you. And that we really have some actors in our society, leaders in our communities, who would very much like to keep us apart because politically that keeps their agenda going. And we have just simply refused to be a part of that agenda. We have an agenda, and that is to bring learning, listening, freedom, and understanding. And I think the most important part of our message is this is not for your listeners. This is not kumbaya. We deeply believe in work towards justice. We believe in change. We believe in actions. And that's the reason we can bring this message of listening and understanding, because there are actions behind it.
So it sounds like you're both looking for
that wider circle of who I am, but you're also looking for the up and down depth of connection to purpose and purpose and values. And those two things together make a pretty strong foundation for building understanding and really powerful listening. I'm going to ask Scott to come through with another question here, and we're going to keep exploring in different directions.
Yeah, to follow up on that, Raja, you mentioned there how it's easy for you two to overcome that supposed wall because of you guys share the same values and you connect on the same things. How can you do that with the whole conflict? How can each side do that as a whole, focusing on what's right instead of who's right?
Look, let's be clear. Here in our book, in our approach, we're talking about Jews and Palestinians here in the diaspora. Folks over there in Israel-Palestine live a different reality. Over here, there are no planes bombing us and there are no missiles being shot at us. Our conflict here is different from the conflict over there. It is not based on daily realities of oppression and violence that the Palestinians over there have to live with. It's not based on, you know, Hamas rockets, you know, falling on someone's head. Over here, our conflict is because of the fact that we do not interact with each other. We do not talk to each other. We do not want to know about each other. We are separated from each other intentionally by groups who want to keep us in our tribes. As Jeff mentioned earlier, these groups spread essentially hateful propaganda, disinformation, anything to keep you in fear of the other and not wanting to be associated with the other and not wanting to know anything about them. And as long as we remain strangers, we're nowhere near where we need to be to start understanding each other. Our book is about understanding the other. It's necessary for a step to go anywhere.
Right. First step is understanding. The second step is to figure out what's possible in terms of action.
Well, yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, you need to first find the common ground that you can build upon.
Yeah.
Do you have thoughts on how that can be initiated? How you can, you know, eliminate that ignorance and have people wanting to learn about the other side?
Stop watching mainstream news and start asking questions. Stop being sucked into sort of the easy answers, the simple story that our brain loves, and start asking complicated questions and look for complex answers.
Yeah, that makes sense, Jeffrey. And it's simple to say and it's challenging to do. Is there one or two pieces of process that you engage in that helps people to enter that complexity and understanding world?
Our key process is through empathy. So for example, in many of our talks, we have had people who closely identify either with the Jewish or Palestinian story and express our pain, their pain to us. And the first thing we do is connect with that experience of trauma. I think we often start to argue, you know, instead of sit back and empathize, not try to win an argument, but to empathize. I would say the second thing, you know, in our process is that we deeply believe that fundamentally humans want other humans to be treated well. And we create a space to be able to view the other's ill treatment and to become concerned and caring about changing that situation.
When you're dealing with personal stories, that's a very good opening to dialogue, because when someone tells their story, it's not something to argue over, or, you know, it's their story. It's their experience. And it's a good way to attune yourself to the listening. And as Jeff said, listening to understand and not to respond, and creating that trust that people are expressing what they feel, what they know, and they're not trying to score points. This is a major hurdle to overcome in dialogue, is to stop defending and making sure that the other person gets your point, but focus on getting their point. It's doable. I've seen it happen.
We often fall into debate and argument as opposed to empathy and understanding. And my background's in early childhood education. And when children are experiencing a difficulty, your first job is to understand and provide support. And from there, problem solving may occur.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think your letters, you know, all of us and your listeners would benefit from a simple truth, which is that we, most all of us, overinflate the value of our own opinion. You don't ever come close to somebody by having an opinion stronger than theirs. You might win an argument, but you will lose the potential to build a new relationship and to make a difference in the world.
And I guess that speaks to what you were saying earlier about this idea of a wider circle and a deeper circle of, you know, if I can focus on what's a higher goal here. Winning an argument's a goal, and we all engage in that to some degree, but understanding and being empathetic and compassionate are a different kind of goal than winning the argument.
Yeah, and the goal becomes about learning. Mm-hmm. You know, you learn from disagreements. Someone agrees with your point, you haven't learned anything.
Right.
If you're focusing on learning from the other, being convinced that this other knows something that you don't know, right?
Yes. I want to move on to another question. There are lots of opinions about the history of this conflict and the ways out of it. As we were just talking about, everybody has opinions. What are people forgetting or ignoring as they look at this situation that we're faced with in the Middle East?
The October 7 experience, to me, showed how little people know and have depth of the history. For some people, they were reacting as if the conflict started on October 7, when in fact it started not even in 1948, but in 1917, when Lord Balfour, the foreign minister of Great Britain, wrote a letter. It's called the Balfour Declaration, in which he says, His Majesty's government looks favorably upon the establishment of a Jewish home in Palestine. Basically, he gave away land that wasn't his to give. In 1917, Britain wasn't in charge, wasn't in control of that part of the world. It's still under the Ottoman Empire. So that's what, for Palestinians, that's when it started. When I saw their land being given away by an imperial force.
I think this is just a really amazing example of looking for complex answers instead of simple ones. So even from the Jewish experience, the 1917 Balfour Declaration, if you dive into it a little more deeply, in many ways, it was created by anti-Semitism in Britain, that they wanted the Jews somewhere else. All of these discussions are complicated. And I think I just would just encourage everyone to, you know, if you hear anything, so if you think of October 7th forward, if you just think of talking points, you know, I condemn Hamas. This is genocide. These are two very, very powerful ideas. Just ask yourself, is this the whole story? Or is this a little sliver that I can't see the whole thing?
And where are you getting your information from?
Yeah.
Is the source, reliable? Do they have a motive in it? You know, you talk to the average Zionist, for instance, about 1948, and they would tell you, well, you know, if the Arabs had accepted the partition agreement that the United Nations put forward, none of this would have happened. The Palestinians would have had a home, and Jews would have had a home, and we would have lived in harmony and peace. And I asked them, sounds great, but how do you know? Like, where did you get that information? How do you know what would have happened if? Of course, no one knows. But that kind of information is out there for a reason. So, and we should question, you know, how do we know the things that we think we know?
So you're urging people to do a couple of things. One is to really be thoughtful and careful about the sources of information and ask that question, how do we know? And then the second piece of what else is attached to this? Is this the whole story? This is very helpful to encourage people to think about complexity by asking themselves questions.
Diversifying the sources of information is essential, especially in the world we live in these days that is polarized, that even news networks are taking sides. They're not the providers of, unbiased information. They used to be. You know, if you listen to CNN, for instance, or you get a very different story than if you listen to Fox News of the same event. Same thing here. Today, no one has any excuse not to diversify their sources of information. They are readily available at our fingertips.
Yeah, I appreciate that you both have busy schedules, so we're going to wrap up here. And I want to bring Jenny in and ask her to tell us a little bit more about this event. There was something else we needed to ask Scott. Help me here.
Yeah, Jenny, we just want to know what's the, you know, obviously we're going to discuss the wall between on Tuesday, December 5th at the event, but what's your hope bringing in these two guests?
hope, Jenny? I'd like to know.
Change the entire world in one evening, right, Jenny?
Yeah, well, I think we can probably wrap this up neatly. You know, we can solve this problem. You know, I hope that attendees will gain some more appreciation of this historical depth and the complexity of this conflict that is often, cited as, you know, the epitome of an intractable conflict. And I also hope that they will get a sense of hope for dialogue across the divide, at least here in Canada. And we'll have some really practical ideas about how we can make such dialogues constructive and helpful, just basically the way Raja and Jeff have explained. It's not the only thing that's needed to get to peace, obviously, but it's one of the things that we who are outside the region can work on, right? Advocating for values we share. First of all, identifying values we share, and then, you know, advocating for those and doing so with a shared understanding and some respect for each other.
Can you tell us about the just how the event's going to work? Where can people go if they want to learn more, get tickets?
Well, you can go to the Selkirk College website and look on the events page, or you can put in MIR lecture, wall between. MIR is spelled M-I-R. It's a word that means peace, community, and world all rolled into one. The tickets are for sale on Eventbrite. There will also be tickets at the door. And I should note that we have an option for just the recording if you can't come in person.
That's great. And again, the event is Tuesday, December 5th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Brilliant Cultural Center. Well, thank you so much, Jeffrey and Raja and Jenny, for joining us. And we encourage our listeners to attend the event if they can, and to also dig in and broaden their understanding and ask the complex questions that we need so that we look at this situation away from the polarized perspectives. This is Kim Bader.
This is Scott Honestjuk.
Reporting for Kootenai Co-op Radio.